Welcome to our session this afternoon. This is session 251, Conspiracy, Delusion, or Revelation, the 180-year controversy over the Book of Mormon Witnesses. I want to remind you right now to check and see if you have your cell phone with you, because I'm sure if you know that you have it, you've already turned it off. But if you forgot that it's still in your pocket, maybe it's still on. And if your cell phone goes off, I'm going to turn you over to Lavina and have her administer justice and no mercy. We're happy to welcome you here. And I'd like to briefly introduce our presenter and our respondent. Our presenter is Don Bradley. He is a Salt Lake City writer and researcher specializing in Mormon origins. He has a BA from BYU. What's your BA in?
History.
In history. And he will be starting a master's program in history at Utah State University in about a week. Our respondent, Mark Thomas, is Director of Field Studies at the Huntsman School of Business at Utah State University. He's a member of the Sunstone Board, and he's done quite a lot of writing about the Book of Mormon and certainly has presented at Sunstone before. So I will turn it over to our presenter.
Can you hear me now? Our microphones have apparently been going in and out, so hopefully this will keep working. Several weeks ago, I happened to be over at the Sunstone offices, and I looked up on the big project board that Mary Ellen had there to plan out the symposium sessions. And from what I saw, I was presenting once on Friday afternoon and once on Saturday. I later discovered that I was presenting once on Friday afternoon and again on Friday afternoon. So I'm going to sleep well tonight. Before I dive into my presentation, I should mention that although I'm going to be covering various proposed explanations for the Book of Mormon Witnesses, I won't be covering every explanation that's been proposed. For instance, some years ago, on a family trip to the Sacred Grove, we encountered at the edge of the grove two personages handing out literature. You may have been one. But, anyway, in their pamphlet, they affirmed that Joseph Smith had, in fact, encountered higher beings in the Sacred Grove and afterward, namely extraterrestrials. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, I won't be covering this theory today, so if you came wanting to hear about E.T. and the Golden Plates, I'm sorry to disappoint. 180 years ago, this summer, 11 witnesses signed testimonies that they, in company with Joseph Smith, had seen the plates from which the Book of Mormon was translated. Three attested to having been shown the plates and associated relics by an angel, and of hearing the voice of God bear witness to the correctness of the book. Eight others, members of the Smith and Whitmer families, including Whitmer in-law Hiram Page, affirmed that they had seen and handled the plates. In the 180 years of controversy, many have attempted to explain these testimonies. But a review of the proposed explanations shows that they're nearly all variants on three basic explanatory strategies, and that most of those attempting to explain the testimonies have done so a little too quickly. Having not examined the evidence carefully, many of those who would explain the testimonies do little more than offer a glimpse into their own view of human beings, as though the golden plates, polished to a high sheen, reflect back the faces of those who look into them. Many sincere religionists have had no trouble accepting the testimonies of the witnesses as true and seeking their own witness of the book. Others have attributed the witness experiences to excessive emotionalism or even the ever-mysterious mesmerism. And still others have viewed the witnesses as conspirators in a plot to palm off the book onto an unsuspecting public. To most, their own explanation seems obvious. Mark Twain, for instance, easily accounted for the 8 witnesses, averring, "I could not feel more satisfied and at rest if the entire Whitmer family had testified." Going against this historical grain, we are going to take some time today to consider various proposed explanations for the Book of Mormon witness testimonies without drawing definitive conclusions. In the next half hour, we'll review the explanations and some of their strengths and weaknesses and see how they might be improved. We'll look at what's known about the witness testimonies and what's not known, but we'll begin, as few of the proposed explanations do, at the beginning, with a look at the origin and evolution of the idea of formal witnesses to the Book of Mormon. In a courtroom near Palmyra, 3 witnesses bore testimony on the existence of the golden plates from which Joseph Smith was said to translate. Each, in his turn, testified that the plates did not exist. The first witness, probably Joseph Smith's former treasure-digging associate, Peter Ingersoll, testified that Smith had told him the box that supposedly contained the plates was actually filled with sand, probably adding, as he did in later affidavits, that Smith said he, quote, "got the damn fools fixed and intended to carry out the fun," a quote you probably won't recognize from the Joseph Smith manual. Another witness reported that Smith had told him the box was full of lead, and a third claimed that Smith had told him it was empty. In addition to highlighting the importance of agreeing on a single story before you go to court, their testimony helps illuminate the first mention of formal witnesses for the existence of the golden plates. The context for this testimony was a March 1829 lawsuit in which Joseph Smith was accused, in his absence, by Lucy Harris of attempting to defraud her husband, Martin. But the testimony of these 3 witnesses against Smith was trumped by that of the supposed victim of the fraud. When Martin Harris himself took the stand, he testified that he didn't believe Joseph Smith had designs on his money, at which point the judge dismissed the case. But there was another, more significant judge who had to render a decision on the testimony of these 3 anti-witnesses, Harris himself. Although he testified in court that Joseph Smith was not trying to defraud him, the unfavorable testimony he'd heard made him doubt his own conviction. Martin Harris soon journeyed to Pennsylvania, insisting to Joseph that he must have greater witness that Smith had the sacred relics. When Harris failed to promptly receive the desired view of the relics, Smith gave what we now have as D&C 5. The revelation predicted that there would be 3 witnesses to the plates whose testimony would be sent out with the published text. It also promised Harris that he could be one of these witnesses, but only if he humbled himself. The March 1829 hearing at Lyons provides an illuminating context for this first revelation on the witnesses. Its triple testimony against the plates explains why the idea of 3 witnesses for the plates would be revealed just a few weeks later. Although this initial revelation had implied that Joseph Smith would be a witness among the 3, the expanded Isaiah prophecy later given in 2 Nephi indicated that these 3 would stand as witnesses alongside Smith, who would not be part of their quorum. In itself, this would have led them to expect a total of 4 witnesses, but the prophecy also indicated that others were to be called as well. While the number of these other witnesses wasn't specified, further revelation dictated by Joseph Smith for Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer raised the expected number of witnesses to 12. Cowdery and Whitmer, who had by this time, in June 1829, been called as witnesses, were commanded to choose apostles, even unto 12. The phrase "unto 12," used in the original revelation, suggests that the number was already partway filled, namely by Cowdery and Whitmer themselves. As witnesses, they just were apostles, since this is what the word apostle means. Cowdery and Whitmer, the revelation declares, were called with the same calling as Paul, mine apostle, and chosen to select other charismatic apostles or witnesses, including the 8, to complete a group of 12. And these 12 witnesses were to be the apostles of the Book of Mormon. As the biblical apostles had testified of Christ's resurrected body and divine sonship, so the Book of Mormon apostles or witnesses were to testify of the physical reality of the plates on which the second testament of Christ was written and of the divine gift by which it was translated. The experiences that constituted these men's witnesses or apostles of the Book of Mormon occurred around the end of June 1829, just after the book's completion. The circumstances of the three witnesses' experience are well known from their own accounts, and one given by Joseph Smith. The prospective witnesses gathered in the woods and began to pray for a manifestation. But Martin Harris, perhaps fearing that the number of witnesses was supposed to be only three, as originally expected, withdrew from the group, blaming himself for the angel's non-appearance. The remaining three soon heard the voice of God testify that the translation was correct and saw an angel descending glory, displaying on a table the golden plates, interpreter's breastplate, Liahona, sword of Laban, and apparently the brass plates. At the end of the vision, the angel whisked away the sacred relics into a cave inside the hill Cumorah, which the witnesses could see remotely. Joseph Smith soon located Harris, and the pair prayed until substantially the same experience was unfolded. Regarding the testimony of eight witnesses, we know much less. In their statement, the eight, like the three, provided only a skeleton of their experience, with no circumstantial detail. But, unlike the three, the eight did not add flesh to these bones in their known informal statements. The upshot of their testimony is simply that they saw and handled. It reads in part, "Joseph Smith Jr. has shown unto us the plates, which have the appearance of gold, and as many of the leaves as the said Smith has translated, we did handle with our hands. And this we bear record with words of soberness, that the said Smith has shown unto us, for we have seen and hefted, and know of a surety, that the said Smith has got the plates, and we lie not, God bearing witness of it." Neither my research nor any published research of which I'm aware has identified a single first-hand account from any of the eight witnesses that expands their published testimony. Only a handful of second and third or third-hand accounts purport to further detail their experience, and these are somewhat inconsistent with one another. There are many questions left open by the historical record. Among these is what is generally regarded as the big question: how should we explain the witness testimonies? Over the years, three broad explanatory strategies have been employed to account for these testimonies. The first, implicit in the testimonies themselves, is to treat them as reflections of a divine revelation. The second is that the testimonies were concocted as part of a conspiracy. The third is to view the testimony experiences as subjectively real, but objectively false. That is, to treat them as what I would call a collective delusion. Each of these strategies dates to the very origin of Mormonism and is still current today. The apologetic, or believing LDS view, that the Book of Mormon witness testimonies reflect divine revelation, has been most effectively presented by Richard L. Anderson. Anderson reads the witness statements at face value and defends them from both the conspiracy and delusion theories by arguing for the witnesses' character and soundness of mind. Based on Anderson's documentation, each of the witnesses appears to have lived a devout and decent life and earned the respect of non-Mormon associates. And Anderson argues cogently that none of the witnesses appears to have turned against his published testimony, even though most became alienated from the LDS Church. Anderson builds a case for the tangible nature of the plates based on the matter-of-fact content and style of the testimony of eight witnesses, a statement devoid of emotionalism, hype, or appeals to religious experience. He argues that the testimony of three witnesses also strongly evidences the tangible reality of the plates. Anderson here participates vigorously in the debate over whether the three saw the angel in the plates with natural eyes or spiritual eyes. Martin Harris told several others, friend and foe alike, that he had seen the plates with spiritual eyes. However, Anderson notes that David Whitmer believed he'd seen the plates with his bodily eyes, albeit after his eyes were first supernaturally prepared for the sight. That is to say, Whitmer believed the three witnesses were first transfigured so they could perceive and endure the presence of a heavenly being. And Anderson further argues that by spiritual eyes, Harris meant something more than his physical eyes, not something less. In other words, that he saw the plates with both physical and spiritual sight. Anderson's arguments on this point become somewhat strained. Martin Harris answered that he'd seen the plates with spiritual eyes, even when the questioner opposed this to seeing with physical eyes. And although David Whitmer believed he saw the angel physically, Whitmer also recounted seeing him return the plates to the cave within Cumorah, a place not naturally visible from Whitmer's location. So at least part of the three witnesses' experience had to be visionary rather than sensory. It is thus a stretch to treat the experience of the three as strong evidence for the physicality of the plates. Another weakness of current scholarship favoring the revelatory model is that it fails to address the formulaic nature of the eight witnesses' unofficial testimonies. These statements merely repeat the scant information provided in their formal testimony, typically in the same words. Arguably, then, we do not have independent idiosyncratic accounts from each of the eight, but a single account repeated over and over by them all. This anomaly is not well explained by existing constructions of the revelatory view. The conspiracy theory of the Book of Mormon witness testimonies is a natural one for skeptics. When a select group of people claims some special private experience that one finds implausible, it may be difficult not to suspect a conspiracy. The disingenuousness of the Book of Mormon witnesses was often assumed by early casual readers of their testimony. Writing within the first year after the Book of Mormon came off the press, the editor of the Evangelical Advocate and Gospel magazine anticipated Mark Twain's reaction to the book, dismissing the testimony of eight in part because it was signed by four Whitmers, one Page, and three Smiths, presumably indicating in his mind a conspiracy between these families. But the conspiracy theory, like the U.S. economy, appears now to have fallen on hard times. This theory enjoys the least current advocacy of any of the common explanatory models and is the least developed of the three. It is sometimes advanced by scholars, though usually in attenuated form. David Persweet, for instance, speculates noncommittally that David Whitmer and Oliver Cowdery may have concocted a fake witness experience so that Martin Harris would be led to have a real one. No doubt, numerous skeptics hold to some degree of conspiracy interpretation of the witness testimonies today, but I'm not aware of any prominent scholar who endorses it or of any recent detailed exposition of it. The theory's current disfavor probably results from historical works such as Anderson's, which argues for the witness's high moral character and religious sincerity. The conspiracy theory is also undermined by the failure of any of the conspirators to break rank and reveal their scheme to the world. But it would be premature to begin singing the theory's funeral dirge. The conspiracy theory enjoys certain advantages that will likely draw to it new champions. For instance, a conspiracy theory could readily explain the formulaic testimonies of the eight witnesses, who might be seen as having agreed to adhere strictly to the content and even wording of their published testimony. Under what I call the delusion theory of the Book of Mormon witness experiences, Joseph Smith manipulated the witnesses into hallucinating. This idea was first put forward in the early 1800s. Ezra Booth, for instance, writing in 1831, asserted of the testimony of three witnesses, "After all, it amounts to simply this, that by faith or imagination, they saw the plates in the angel." Booth failed to deal with the eight witnesses at all, or to explain how they imagined hefting a large book of plates, reflecting a weakness of the delusion approach. Its advocates typically neglect or misrepresent the experience of the eight. For instance, modern writers as disparate as evangelical critic Floyd McElveen and atheistic skeptics James Randi and Paul Kurtz say that the eight had been shown the plates by an angel and omit to mention that they reported handling the plagues. These interpreters subsumed the experience of the eight under that of the 12, and under that of the three, and thus create a straw man they find easier to burn. A welcome exception to this refusal to engage the testimony of the eight witnesses is Dan Vogel, fourth row over here. Vogel has raised what I'm calling the delusion theory to a higher level. Vogel summarily categorizes the experience of the three witnesses as spiritual, as a spiritual rather than a physical experience. He then shows that each of the three witnesses had experienced previous visions, arguing that this susceptibility made them relatively easy marks for Smith. And he documents that a significant minority of persons can be made to hallucinate under the power of suggestion. Vogel takes a more complex approach to the experience of the eight, seeking to explain how they could have experienced seeing and hefting a set of ancient plates that did not exist. To account for their reports that they both saw and hefted, Vogel posits that Smith lived up to his name by smithing a set of tin plates. The idea that Joseph Smith employed a plate prop long predates Vogel's hypothesis. Tales of a prop were in circulation no later than 1835, when John Murdoch recorded one in his missionary journal. Joe Smith is a base, corrupt, and wicked man. He employed an artist in the city of Utica to engrave on glass plates in a shorthand characters by promising to reward him if he would keep it a secret. But after Smith had obtained the plates, he would not pay according to agreement, whereby the artist became dissatisfied and divulged the secret. No doubt in the sequel to this tale, the artist also forged a metallic angel who appeared to the three witnesses and now sits atop the Palmyra Temple. But be that as it may, Hubble does not appear... Hubble was the one who made that statement. I'm having to skip some things. To explain how Joseph Smith passed off the newly manufactured plates as ancient and made of gold. Vogel resolves this problem by having the witnesses handle the plates only through a cloth and see them only in a vision. But even Vogel's refined version of what I'm calling the delusion theory falls short of comfortably explaining the data. And now I'm gonna pick on Dan because I can take it. Vogel argues that Smith used the power of suggestion to produce visions, but doesn't say much about how Smith pulled off the feat of producing eight simultaneous visions, other than that he had the witnesses pray. Appealing to the power of suggestion in such a general way is like appealing to genius to explain how Joseph Smith could have written the Book of Mormon. It looks less like a complete explanation and more like a prop standing in for one. Vogel must also read into the testimony of eight the notion that they saw the plates by supernatural means. In these statements, the witnesses appear to describe seeing the plates in a normal way. Vogel therefore builds his interpretation to a great extent on a single phrase from an 1845 account by Theodore Turley of an 1839 conversation with John Whitmer. In this account, Turley recalled Whitmer affirming that the plates had been shown him by a supernatural power, implying that his experience was visionary. Turley's verbal inerrancy is suspect, not only because his Whitmer quotation was recorded years after it was heard, but also because the statement, as reported, contradicts both the explicit wording of the testimony of eight and John Whitmer's first-hand account in his private history of the church, the Book of John Whitmer, in which the witness affirms that the plates were shown him by Joseph Smith rather than a supernatural agency. While Vogel has clearly refined the delusion theory of the witnesses, he has not perfected it. This explanation, like the others that have been set forth, fails to account for much of the relevant data. Each theory is thus far incomplete. Before moving on, I should say a further word about the controversy over whether the witnesses saw with their natural eyes or their spiritual eyes. And I'm just going to summarize this part real quick. Basically, the spiritual eyes interpretation gets conflated with the idea of a hallucination. But the term hallucination in standard dictionary definitions, and I've looked at several, does not mean simply seeing something that's not physically present. It means seeing something, it means perception without an external cause. But if the vision is provided by God, then God would be the external cause, and so the term hallucination would not apply. I would therefore argue that the spiritual eyes versus natural eyes debate is not all important. The validity of the testimony of three witnesses does not depend on it, because this testimony is not about providing evidence that Joseph Smith possessed particular sacred artifacts. But if the testimony is not about such evidence, what is it about? What is its purpose? To answer this question, we need to look at the biblical model for the witness experiences and how the witness testimonies function within Book of Mormon faith. We noted earlier that 12 witnesses of the Book of Mormon, that the 12 witnesses of the Book of Mormon were a parallel set to biblical 12 apostles who had been witnesses of his resurrection, Christ's resurrection, because they had seen and handled his risen body. As the earlier apostles had seen and handled Christ's body, the 8 witnesses to the Book of Mormon saw and handled the plates. In each of these sets of 12 witnesses, 3 men were singled out for a special experience not shared by the entire set. In the Bible, the select 3 were Peter, James, and John, who on the Mount of Transfiguration saw heavenly beings and heard the audible voice of God testify of Jesus' divine sonship. In early Mormonism, the chosen 3 were Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris, the 3 witnesses, who, while in a state of transfiguration, as they reported, saw a heavenly being and heard the audible voice of God testify of the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith, curiously, shared the experience of each of these groups, but isn't enumerated as part of either. Both the experience shared by all the New Testament witnesses, that of seeing and handling Jesus' body, and the experience shared by most of the Book of Mormon witnesses, that of seeing and handling the plates, provided tangible evidence of spiritual realities. And the experience shared by the select New Testament 3 and that shared by the Latter-day 3 both provided a spiritual witness, a testimony from on high of those same realities. This parallel of the Book of Mormon witnesses to the biblical apostles helps illuminate their testimonies. Why is the testimony of 8 so matter-of-fact, not even mentioning God outside of its oath of affirmation, while the testimony of 3 is so rife with God? Because the two testimonies have entirely different purposes. The testimony of 8 is devoid of the spiritual because it is about providing physical evidence meant to appeal to the intellect. But the testimony of 3, like the biblical transfiguration, is about spiritual manifestation. While the function of the testimony of 8 is evidentiary, that of the testimony of 3 is exemplary. What it provides, strained apologetic arguments to the contrary, is not evidence for the tangibility of the plates, but a model for obtaining one's own witness. The reader of the Book of Mormon and the testimony of 3 witnesses sent out with it is not, of course, to expect to encounter an angel and hear the audible voice of God, but he or she is to expect, as the book itself promises, that God will speak inaudibly, but nevertheless perceptibly, from heaven to bear witness that the book is true. The testimony of 8 witnesses was meant to be put forward as evidence, and therefore to be debated and put under the intellectual microscope to determine its evidentiary value. But to treat the testimony of 3 in this way is to miss its particular point. The testimony of 3 witnesses doesn't tell us we should believe because of the experience of others. It challenges us to obtain an experience and become witnesses ourselves. Thank you.
Nadine, give me a cue in about 15 minutes if
okay.
I'm not done. Okay.
All right.
Okay. I've been listening over and over again to a piece. Magnificat by Bach. There's a piece in there, Facit Potentia, and it sounds something starting out like something out of Handel's Messiah. You know, the tenor's doing the 16th notes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that kind of thing. But all of a sudden, and our dean could explain this, I'm just a violist, I don't understand theory, the bottom falls out. He hits chords that surprise you, And all of a sudden, you hear, this is an extraordinary piece because it throws you off entirely. I've listened to this piece over and over again, and I never get tired of it. And I'm in that same mode when I read these testimonies of the witnesses. These things are fascinating, they are rich, and I have a prediction that in about 5 or 6 years, we're going to understand these in ways that we've never understood them before. And I think this is the work that's been done today is moving in that direction. I'd like to talk a little about how I see one little sliver of this experience. There was, I think, there's been demonstrated here today by Don that there was some kind of experience to at least some of the people. There was an experiential component to this thing. And the pure conspiracy of all 12 people seems implausible given the historical context. And I think that much he's convinced me of, among other things. But I'd like to talk about how we can go from the written word describing the experience to what the experience meant, to maybe what the experience was like, moving backwards. And by starting, I'd like to start by giving a few examples of what endorsements. This is kind of a religious endorsement of a book in Joseph Smith. Here's one that might have been taken place had Joseph Smith gone to Charles Anthon a little differently. A fascinating manifestation of religion's devotion. You know, you might see that on the back of a book. It may be an endorsement. Or this one. One of the great contributions in American religious history. I couldn't put it down. God. But I don't think that's what the voice said. But notice what I said. That seems so funny because it's so true. That's what we see on books, both in Joseph Smith's time and our own. This is extraordinarily, just like the Magnificat from Bach, the trapdoor falls, and you see things that just don't make any sense. And so let's talk about these. The first one, DNC 17, talks about the witnesses and why this experience was going to happen. Michael Marquardt pointed this out to me, and I think it's an interesting insight. So that my servant Joseph Smith shall not be destroyed. What are they talking about? I have no idea. I think this is probably pure drama. And that's what makes this whole experience so interesting. This is not a boring endorsement. This is something that jumps in your face and threatens you. And it threatens you in several ways. One, by saying that life and death is at stake here. Okay, number one, that this is a divine endorsement. That I think this is correct, that the 8 witnesses are making a factual claim. The plates are there. There are real objects. The 3 witnesses seem to be making the same claim, but it's subsumed under a much bigger vision. Their divine endorsement that the work is true, these things are true, are the words that are used in their testimony. But what kind of witnesses have we got? The DNC says that they have to have faith before they can have this experience. In other words, these are not random selections. This is not a survey of people walking by and you say, come in this tent and we'll show you an angel and see some plates and you write down what you see. So already, this makes people feel a little nervous. You've got to believe this before you even start on the trip. Which is maybe an admission that we really see what we expect to see and we really see what we believe in the first place anyway. But I can't buy that entirely. I'm sorry. I still believe in objectivity in some sense. So all of a sudden you start feeling nervous about this testimony, about its boldness, about its literary features that help us understand the experience. Both witnesses start out, "Be it known unto all nations, kindreds, tongues, and people," from the book of Revelation, the voice of an angel in the last days, right? This is a cosmic apocalyptic event. This is not just a scientific experiment. This is not just a bunch of witnesses seeing something. This is a seminal work in the work of God. I use this as evidence, and other reasons, for evidence. This is pure Joseph Smith, the repetition of biblical parallels. This phrase is throughout the Book of Mormon. And, for example, in half a dozen of the early revelations, a great and marvelous work is about to come forth, over and over and over again. That's the style, biblical parallels to make a point, and to give biblical character. But notice how thorough this evidence is. The eight witnesses touch the plates. They see the plates. They have an ancient appearance. The voice of God is heard, declaring that the Book of Mormon was translated by the gift and power of God. So you see, hear, and feel. You're using all of your senses in this experience. It's thorough in that sense. But notice the wording used here. Again, another literary feature. The voice of God tells the audience that this is translated by the gift and power of God. What would that have meant to somebody in Joseph Smith's day? The gift of God, I think he meant the gift of seeing, the seer stones. The power of God had a particular meaning in the Joseph Smith context, and it goes back to the debate between formal and experiential religions. The revivalists that believed you experience religion, or you don't have it, and the formalists who were pure theologians. So Joseph Smith was saying that this is on the side of the evangelicals, the radicals, the prophets of the radical Reformation. This is the kind of people, so you notice in the Book of Mormon it talks about the power of God, people are falling down, like in a revival. You know, they see visions. So this is making a particular appeal to a particular group of people. These are young people who are attracted to revivals generally, teenagers, and they're people who are anti-establishment. So right here, we're using language literary language that's going to appeal to a certain group. The voice of God, an interesting thing, is in the New Testament, but it really goes back thousands of years in Judaism as well. David Whitmer, the interesting thing about the voice of God, David Whitmer, as Michael Marquardt has pointed out to me again, that he said that he heard the voice of God tell him he should leave the LDS movement. So the problem with the voice of God is that it may say contrary things. The Jews understood this problem anciently, and I think it's in the Talmud, where there's a debate between rabbis about the meaning of a particular phrase in the Hebrew Bible. And they debated to the full extent of what they could using logic and scriptural precedent. They couldn't come to a conclusion, so one of the rabbis says, okay, that's it. God, tell us what the answer is. And the voice of God comes down and says, yes, you are right. This side of the argument wins. And the other rabbis say, we refuse to accept that because it's not in the text. This is a very funny story, but it's a serious story. I mean, I'm not sure how serious they were when they said this, but this Jewish story about the voice of God being something that simply doesn't count. So this voice of God notion is one that goes back thousands of years. Interesting and we see pieces of it with Jesus, the baptism of Jesus and the Mount of Transfiguration. What is being the voice of God saying? This is the Messiah, my son. What is it saying in the witnesses? That this book is true. You read the Book of Mormon and that's exactly what the voice of God is saying. This is an unusual thing, an apocalyptic book, a book at the end of the world. It's not Superman, it's not a messianic figure, it's a book. The book is the messianic figure. So by appealing to the voice of God, it kind of throws what you normally see as in apocalyptic literature, the evil age being turned over by a messianic figure to what we call the millennium. An unusual tact here. The central point of the Book of Mormon is being witnessed to. Finally, the symbolism of blood. In the witnesses, the three witnesses say that they will go with this witness. God commands them to do this. So there's a seriousness here. God commands them, you have to do this, and we can go now to the bar of God and his blood. Your blood will not be upon our garments. What's the implication? Your blood is out there. Blood is a pre-theological symbol. It's a gut, visceral symbol of guilt. You see it all over the place, and it's a kind of an Old Testament kind of image, that stain, that evil is represented by blood upon garments. That's guilt. That's a foreign substance, a foreign living substance that infects you. That's a fascinating, deep psychological image that in this case is intended as a threat to the reader. Notice all that's going on in these testimonies. Again, the trap doors keep falling on me. Finally, Sterling McMurrin, in a famous interview, said he simply did not believe in Mormonism because angels do not appear to people. And
No, angels don't give books to people.
Don't give books to people. Ah, they may appear to people, but they don't give books to people. That's the difference. Okay. Thank you. Okay, they don't give books to people. The interesting thing about this is angels do nothing but give books to people. In the slums of Bangkok, where children are sold as slaves, a Catholic priest comes and buys them off. In a woman's house who's desperate, gaunt, betrayed by her husband and children, not knowing what to do, some dream, a book appears. So in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, it seems that books do pop up. And why? That's the question. The question is just the opposite. Why are there so many books and so many angels? Tests have been done by psychologists that at the time of death, in times of crisis, 50 to 80%, depending on the study, of the people have heard a voice, seen the dead person, or felt their presence. A young boy, for example, in Massachusetts, this was done by an MD, interviewed this family, the young boy whose father had been lost out at sea sometime earlier, in the middle of the night, went to his mother and said, "Mom, Dad came to me. He says he's okay." So the question is, why are all these angels coming with all these books to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people? And that's the question I have, and I have no answer.
I'd like to thank both of our presenter and our respondent for a very thought-provoking session. My recollection of that Sterling McMurrin quote is, "You don't get books from angels and translate them by miracles." I would like to now open this up to any questions, and let's see if this microphone works. If it doesn't, we'll try again.
Hello?
Can you hear him back there?
No.
Could you come up here and ask your question?
I have a couple of questions. I remember reading about how after Joseph had the three witnesses see the book, he came home and said to Emma how relieved he was because he was no longer the single person carrying the burden of being the witness. It would be interesting to hear you expand on that. Two other comments. There are many accounts of Emma and others who talk about how he would leave the plates underneath a cloth on the table, almost cavalierly, kind of leaving them around. You almost wonder whether he was tempting people to look at them. And Emma talked about how she could feel the gold plates under the cloth. And one wonders, if he was a fraud, why was he so cavalier in treating the plates? You'd think he would be desperate at trying to conceal this fraud and more careful about it. And the second question is, I've heard some people talk about how they couldn't believe in the church because there were different accounts, contradictory accounts of the first vision as well as the witnesses of the golden plates. And not that it dismisses that inconsistency, but if that is the standard by which you judge whether something is true, then you can't believe in the Bible either, because there are four very distinct and contradictory accounts of the resurrection. So therefore, the Bible's not true either if you use that same standard by which you judge all things. So I was just curious to hear your comments on that.
The account of Joseph coming inside after the three witnesses see the plates, it's actually Lucy, his mother, that he comes to and says how relieved he is, and she puts that in her family memoir. I don't know that I have any other particular comments on that. The question sort of why would Joseph Smith have been so cavalier with the plates if there were no real plates and it was just a prop? Certainly, it's a good question. I think I can certainly imagine answers that could be given. For instance, well, he really was perfectly confident that Emma wouldn't look at the plates. You know, he knew her well enough. If someone had looked at the plates, he could have said, well, you know, and they saw a prop, he could have said, well, I knew that you were going to do that, and so I didn't actually put the real plates there, I just put a prop. As far as the inconsistency of the witness testimonies, there are certainly several varying accounts of the first vision. I don't think the witness testimonies are so much inconsistent. Dan has argued that the witnesses may have actually experienced different things to some extent, and I thought his arguments on that were quite good. But like I said, I don't. On the whole, I don't really see inconsistency in their accounts.
Don, I'm either going to. Oh, I'm sorry. You're going to.
I just wanted to say that if we really are believers, that we need to be serious about scholarship, and it's messy. But if we deny that, if we throw out Dan and Don and the other people that are doing this, we're throwing out our own souls. So I think we're too afraid of things that don't quite work, but we've got to face it if we're serious about our faith.
I'm either showing my own ignorance again or lobbing you a softball question here. The timeline of the witnesses' testimony would have been logically a handwritten document in Joseph Smith's handwriting, followed by their signatures, which would have been taken to a printing press at some point in time and included. What's the timeline, and is there any information on at what point in time was their statement composed and before it was ended up in print?
That I think is a really good question. If the witness testimonies were already composed before the witness experiences, and if they had been composed by Joseph Smith or under revelation, then the witness testimonies themselves would be essentially part of the witness's preparation for their experiences, because the testimonies would tell them part of what they were going to experience. Unfortunately, there's really not information directly given about the authorship of the testimonies. They seem to have a common style, so it makes sense that perhaps Joseph Smith provided the wording for both. They could also be group statements, and that sort of, I think that can be figured out, but I think it would require a good deal of textual analysis and inference.
All right. I have a few comments to Don, a little critique of how he approached the problem of the witnesses. Now, I started with a naturalistic position because I believe that evidence for historicity of the Book of Mormon is wanting, and that there is no direct evidence for the Book of Mormon. So the most rational position is to take with the Book of Mormon that it's not history. If that's true, then you look for a naturalistic explanation. No matter how hard it is to fathom multiple hallucinators, they do exist. There are histories about it. It does happen in Lourdes. It does happen with the UFO sightings, that people cross-pollinate each other during the experience. And no one can really check. If someone says, oh, I saw the angel with the plates, they don't know if it's the same vision or not. But so it's a fact. I thought you didn't treat the phenomenon of multiple hallucinators at all. But and then I thought you glided over the Theodore Turley statement where he heard John Whitmer in 1839 in Missouri, the dissenters, as a whole, were countering the Book of Mormon with stories, both in Missouri and Ohio, with Martin Harris in public saying that the eight witnesses didn't really see the plates. And I take it that he meant with their natural eyes, that no one has seen them with their natural eyes, he said. And he made that as a public statement, not fearing contradiction. And he had personal knowledge of the eight witnesses. And so the Turley statement occurs in a historical context. It's not isolated. Plus, he dictated it to Thomas Bullock in 1845. And it was put into the history of the church by people who knew the witnesses. And neither Turley nor the historians that put it into the history saw any contradiction in it. And when you said that the Turley statement contradicted the eight witnesses' testimony, that's kind of begging the question. There's not enough information in the testimony of eight witnesses because it's a brief statement. It gives no details. All they say is they saw the plates and they look like this. It doesn't go into detail of how it was shown to them, which you conceded it right off at the beginning. And in my articles, I spent a lot of time discussing why you can't take the testimony of the witnesses at face value. I went through the three witnesses first to show that their experiences were much more vast than the little statement of the testimony implies. If you just read this testimony of the three witnesses, you would assume that they all saw the vision at the same time and that the angel was in a very natural situation. But from subsequent statements, you learn that Martin Harris didn't see it at the same time and that the angel was in a light, and David Whitmer said on numerous occasions that it was through a soft haze and that the environment around was not natural. And so you get to the testimony of the eight witnesses, and sure, we have a lot less evidence for their experience, no details of the events leading up to it or of what it looked like or how it was done. So I take the statement of John Whitmer to Theodore Turley that he saw them, he was shown to the plates by supernatural power, and the fact that they all unanimously say that they handled the plates. So I try to solve those two things, seeing by spiritual sight and handling them physically. And I looked to Martin Harris during that same statement in 1838, reported by Stephen Burnett. He said before he saw them as one of the three witnesses, he saw them many times. He held them on his knee, and he saw them as a city through a mountain, through the cloth. So I took that as a model of a possible way of solving the spiritual sight and the physical handling of the plates. And when the weight of the plates come out to be consistent with the weight of tin, which was readily available in his environment and easily constructed. So do you want to respond?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, thank you, Dan. There's only so much that I can do in a 30-minute presentation, and you're absolutely right that I did glide over the Turley statement, and basically I had to glide over just about everything that I hit on. In the larger paper, I will be covering more of your argument. One thing that I really wanted to include was a discussion of the Stephen Burnett statement that you referred to. Because that does provide important context for your larger explanation, very vital context. I think it's dangerous to build too much on just a particular phrase, especially when it's remembered after a several-year lag. And I don't think the fact that this phrase was included in the history of the church as part of the statement means that that people looked necessarily at the very precise meaning and implications of it and said, oh yeah, this is right, this is what we remember the witnesses saying. I think that's reading too much in and trying too hard on that. Oh yeah, yeah.
The statement contradicted the eight witnesses.
Right, I did. It does. It does. It contradicts because... you know, unlike with the testimony of three witnesses, where you're saying the testimony, you would assume from the testimony that they all saw it together. However, the testimony doesn't explicitly say they all saw it together. Whereas with the testimony of eight, it explicitly says Joseph Smith showed us the plates. And so does John Whitmer in his own history that he's writing.
He did either way. He showed them the plates. He's the one who brought them there. But that doesn't tell you anything about how they saw them.
I think the idea of Joseph Smith showing them, at least the implication, is that they were seen naturally. I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm saying that's the implication. And, yeah, I think that does it.
Regrettably, I have to be the heavy here and end this on time, and we're already past time. So maybe this discussion can continue in the hallways. But thank you all for coming in. Thank you for-